So Barry Siegel is an American journalist and former national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 2002 for his piece, A Father's Pain, A Judge's Duty, and A Justice Beyond Their Reach. He is also the chair of the UC Irvine's undergraduate degree program in literary journalism, of which I'm honored to be a graduate of. He is the director of the Center for Storytelling at UC Irvine as well, and is the author of 8 books, 5 nonfiction and 3 fiction. Honestly, I have always known you to be awesome, thoughtful, and a wonderful storyteller. So thanks again. Did I miss anything that you would like to add?
No, I think you got it all, Jerise. Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
This is great. All right, so kind of starting out, we want to talk about freedom of speech and especially the role of journalists in the United States. What do you think is the main role of journalists in the United States?
Well, you should know, like when I was first coming up in the field, we had a little mantra about this, that the role of the journalist was to, role of the journalist was to empower the powerless and oppress the powerful. And I think that that might be a good mantra to hang on to as a central thought. And I think that but beyond that, because yeah, that obviously is a pointed like a goal, but I think of course we also just have a more general responsibility to keep the American public informed, and this is critical in a democracy. To just to keep everybody, it's like a continuing education as we go through life, and so the I like both of those. Keep them informed, and then when we can empower the powerless and oppress the powerful.
I love that. I know this podcast, originally my idea for it was to come up with lots of different topics, from politics and medicine and those sort of things. I've done like a, I did a one on Ouija boards and the science behind Ouija boards. But I find myself really trending toward politics right now, with everything going on, because I feel like it is so important. And my friends were like, Darice, you got to do some lighter topics. And I said, this isn't a, these aren't light times, so it's hard to do
No,
that.
it's hard to turn away as we as painful as it is sometimes to keep exposing ourselves. We have to say stay aware.
Absolutely. It can be draining for sure.
Oh man, it's
My husband will come home sometimes and I've consumed the news almost all day. And
yeah.
he'll say, I want to watch the national news. I'm like, no, you don't. You don't. I'll just give you a summary.
I keep on telling myself I'm going to switch it all off because of how upsetting everything is, but I never do.
No.
I think I'm kind of addicted, but I think behind the or what's driving the addiction is if is a feeling or an impulse to always be aware.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, there's a term that has been used a lot in the past, let's say 10 years, fake news. When you hear the term fake news, do you think there is any truth to journalism or the media not checking facts? Or is it just a ploy to delegitimize the media?
That to me, that's an easy question, Teresa. It's a ploy. It most clearly is a ploy, but let's clarify this though, or because I don't want to make it that simple. The term fake news is obviously a created term to delegitimize, but that does not mean that journalists always get everything right. It's unavoidable that you're going to make mistakes, particularly say on the newspaper level. You're moving fast and you're trying, you got deadlines and you've got a paper out. And even if you're working on more like a magazine article, the process of getting everything right is challenging, even if you are determined to do so. So what I resist about this term fake news is the notion that where somebody is purposely making things up and faking it. That's absolutely diametrically opposite of what we do. But at the same time, we have to recognize the imperfection of the people and the process. That is why newspapers carry a box every day called corrections. You're not gonna, there's very rarely will that box be empty, but the very bad fact that it exists, I think, is indicative of how much the journalists value accuracy. If they get it wrong, they don't want to duck it. They want to, the next day it's there's the correction. So. But
For sure.
that's not fake news. That's not fake news.
Yeah, exactly. I know I've right after I graduated from UC Irvine, I was writing longer pieces for like Gizmodo. I did a few about ketamine, how they use ketamine for treatment-resistant depression. But I had a big long deadline, like 3, 4 months to work on the story. So I could really go in and make sure I got everything, very accurate. With this podcast, I'm trying to get out an episode every 2 weeks. And as a one man, one woman show, that is really hard, and also being a mom and a wife and having a life outside, So, so if I make mistakes, it bothers me, but I'm also like, wow, but this is a really, tough timeline.
Well, so here's one of the things that not just myself, but my colleagues, because we would talk about it at the LA Times in the many years I was a correspondent there. We would spend, I mean, the kinds of pieces we did, we would spend months on them sometimes because we were in a group that was allowed to do these long form narratives. Okay, now it was, we went through a whole multiple levels of copy editors, readers, fact checkers. It had to clear a lot of hurdles. Copy editors were working more on your mistakes of grammar and the writing, but we also had fact checkers, particularly for the Sunday magazine. I had to hand over all my notes and let them call people and such like that. A lot of my colleagues resisted that because we didn't do it in the newspaper proper itself. It was just for the Sunday magazine because they used a lot of freelancers. My colleagues resisted that, and I actually welcomed it because I wanted to find out. Yeah, please do. Let's find out. But I can tell you something, and that is, I can't tell you how regularly we would, those of us who worked on these projects, would, in the days before they were about to be published, lay in bed at night, sleepless, staring at the ceiling, scrolling through our mind. Scrolling through our mind, trying to, what did we, that was the always the fear that we had gotten something wrong. We had already made the prose as pretty as we could make it and figured out our structure. But did you just get something wrong that is now going to appear on the front page of the LA Times with your byline on it? And that to us was a constant kind of attention. And the only way you could deal with it is to be Barry is to scrutinize, scrutinize, scrutinize.
Yeah, it's true. I wrote this first article about ketamine for Gizmodo, and the people I interviewed, I always say, hey, here's the link, check it out. And I heard someone say, oh, don't do that because they're gonna, scrutinize your stuff and have problems with it or whatever. I'm like, yeah, that's okay. I wrote it the best I could. And so one guy, he was just such a scientific mind, and he took exception to just this teeny tiny little detail. Wasn't necessarily asking for a correction, but I still remember it. I still remember that he was like, well, but this was misleading. And I'm like, ooh, but was it? And it really bothered me. And it still does. But I'm
And
also
that's
like,
it.
yeah,
And Teresa, there's a lot of pressure involved there because if I could divide, explain the sort of the kind of tug of war that's going on, because we want to correct facts that are wrong, that are just wrong, but we also have, our subjects will also just want it to. Express their viewpoint,
Right. Yep.
and which is different than saying it's incorrect.
Right. Very true.
And that's what you were just describing.
Yeah.
You will have subjects you're never going to satisfy the people write about, and they're all going to have their own narrative
Right.
about themselves, and that is different from factual accuracy. And there's a point where we have to maintain control of the narrative because we're the ones who are telling the story. And
Yes,
so
that's true.
there's a built-in tension there.
That's true. It's hard, but I love it. So your career began around 1972 after you graduated from Columbia with your master's in journalism. How has journalism changed during your career? And then also, how has the perception of journalism changed, if it
Yeah,
has?
well, it's the sea change. It's just, I mean, it's not recognizable, the world I went into. And yes, you're right. My career began in 1972 when I graduated, but I actually was an intern at a couple at Portland Oregonian and the Washington Post even before that. So I've been hovering around newspapers since about 1970, I think. And well, let me, I don't let the list goes on and on, but let's just first say the obvious fact is that when I began, there was a lot of newspapers and they were fat, thick, many pages because they had many ads in them, which, by the way, is how our work was financed. It wasn't the reader's 50 cents or whatever. It was all those advertising department stores and whatever buying ads. So it was an ad thick, pages thick newspaper world. A lot of papers and a lot of influence and power. And I timed it right.
You did.
I left that world and came to UC Irvine. It's now been 22 years. And in that period, of course, we've all watched a real decline. And I don't mean necessarily in the spirit or the quality, I'm talking about the business model. The business model has gone off the rails. And the obvious answer is thank you, Internet. Which just has sucked away all those big advertisements. And in fact, it was before even the internet sucked away the big display ads. I'm not sure most people maybe even recall the pages and pages of classified ads that used to run in newspapers. Well, and nor do people realize that those classified ads provided about 40% of the advertising revenue that newspapers made. It was pages and pages of classified ads. So what blew that out of the water? Craigslist.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Craigslist blew out the the classified ads, and then the internet, of course, just you could target your advertisers could start advertising more and more on the internet, and being able to target specific audiences rather than buy a costly big display ad in a general interest newspaper. So advertising revenue shrinks, the papers shrink and go out of business. So there's just a lot less, and it's and that part of it is a business model just has gone off the rails. But I will say, in place of the newspaper, those newspapers, we have seen just an enormous explosion of other kinds of platforms for news, for storytelling. Obviously, on that very internet that carried the print, there's just so many different platforms. My students come in the LJ program. Yes, some of them go get jobs on the remaining newspapers, but they also find so many places, platforms on the internet where they can either get jobs or certainly place articles. So it's the environment has shifted. The other thing that I would say about the change, though, is that there used to be, and this is beyond the issue just of the shrinking business model, there used to be a shared narrative, whether or not, you know, people, of course, still disagree back in the day. You know, it's it, we then there was plenty of polarized thought, thinking, right wing, left wing, top, bottom, whatever. But we began that process all by watching the same news. There, first of all, there wasn't all these cable stations. You had the three main network news, evening news, NBC, ABC, CBS. Okay, and you just mainly, which one are you going to watch? Walter Cronkite, or you know, or Peter Jennings, and so it just Huntley Brinkley. But you're basically everybody was witnessing the same narrative, and then having different, you're still having different responses. The huge difference now is there is no central narrative in community journalism. We live in an environment now where there are just multiple narratives, depending on, and you depending on your bent, your inclination, will read or turn on that narrative or that narrative. So you have this incredible balkanization of what used to be a shared narrative. I think this is beyond consequential because we're not. You're the ability, you, we're not experiencing the same world.
It's very true. It's almost like you can think about, even if it's subconsciously, your own confirmation bias and find the exact media outlet that feeds into that, you know.
And you do, and then you, and that's where you stay.
And that's where you stay. Because it isn't, even as someone who tries to be balanced, I have a hard time going to media outlets that I don't like, you know, the what they're saying. I don't like the narrative that they're telling. It is painful. I still try to do it, so I, you know, am informed, but it hurts. So it's more comfortable to go, you know, for someone just to go, I'm gonna just watch this and, you know, or listen to this. And it is kind of interesting too, how, like you're talking about, it used to be all newspapers, and I remember the classifieds. That's how I got my first job, in the classified ad. But now, you know, like even just what I'm doing, you know, I'm trying to focus a lot on YouTube, and for me to make a profit, I have to get subscribers, and to get subscribers, I have to fancy up my videos and my content, you know, in a way that keeps people's attention. And I don't want that to change what I'm producing, but I do find myself having to really like think about how things are put together so I can get subscribers. And it's really hard, you know. It's like such a flooded market.
And that is a major change. Well, let me say a couple of things. First of all, at least you have these opportunities, you know.
Absolutely.
That's why when certain doors close, others open, and here you are, you know. And at least you can, and you do it. But you're absolutely right. It puts you in a position you want to be a leader of some thoughts and insights and such. But you also have to be a marketer, and this is a profound difference. I will be honest with you. In all my years, I was at the LA Times for 28 years. One of the things that, particularly in the era where I was working, it shields me from marketing because, and why? Well, because paper is real big, thick, has a lot, over a million readers, and that no one's going out from their house to go into the store or wherever or their driveway. Say, I want to buy Barry Siegel's latest long form narrative. They could be
Mean
going to
they
get the paper.
should, but
They're a mistake, but they're going to, maybe they're going to get the sports scores or the movie scenes. There used to be movie advertisement for movies in paper. You see that? All kinds of things, reasons why you might be picking up a newspaper, but then lo and behold, on the front page, there's this long form narrative by one of us. And so we get read. But it wasn't that kind of necessarily conscious. Where I began to really encounter the marketplace, I've been so protected, was when I began writing books. Because
That's
that's
big.
obviously you can't just write a book. You've got you that book has to sell, and somebody does have to pick that book up and decide to pick up that book by me. Not you know, I got no sports scores or movie listings inside those covers. So that becomes, and not only do I have to be concerned with marketing, but in fact, to sell a book proposal to a publisher, they are not just simply making an editorial judgment like my newspaper editors would. I turn an article to them, all they're trying to decide is how well did he do it and does he got it right and is it important or whatever. The book publisher has to ask the question, will it sell?
That is a tough question to answer too,
Yes. It's
I mean,
impossible to answer. It's
I
immediate. They don't know, but they have to
yeah.
act and choose anyway.
I know with when I'm picking my content, I have to go on to like Google Trends and see what people have been searching for, and I hate to cater to that, but sometimes you need to, it's just kind of how it is now, but just put my Doree spin on things, So you have traveled all over the world in your career. Is the role of the media in the United States unique compared to other countries, or do you think, the experience is universal?
Well, I don't. I can tell you what I sort of have a sense of, but I want to correct that a little bit. I don't have that much expertise because I really haven't traveled all over the world in my career. I was a roving national correspondent for the LA Times, so I think I've been in all 50 states during those 28 years, or almost all. I don't think I got to Alaska, and maybe one or two others, but I've traveled all over our country. And I have, for some stories, I've gotten down into South America and to the Pacific Islands, one time to London, but I'm not really in that way where I was that exposed to the role of journalism all through the world. But what I can say is that as long as we are a democracy, and of course that's up for question now, we inevitably have a stronger journalism than you could possibly have in a country that is enjoying a democracy.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
And of course, that's what one of your themes here, Therese, is about freedom of the press and all of that. And of course, that's we're watching a lot of pressure
Yeah, I
right
know.
here in our country that we that's another major change.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's I kind of, the question is, can you call yourself a democracy if you don't have a fully independent press? I mean, political leaders are never gonna love everything that you say about them, for sure. But like you were talking before, it's about educating the public on what's going on. And I don't know. I mean, do you think we can call ourselves a democracy if we don't have an independent press?
Yeah, no, I think no, we can't. I don't. I
Yeah.
think that independent press is essential to a democracy. And your question recalls to me very well-known, famous comments made by Thomas Jefferson many years ago when our country was just forming, in which he talked about the necessity of a free press for a democracy. Here's one of his quotes. I have it here for you. "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter."
Interesting. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Necessity of a free press for democracy was a main theme he championed. Now, I just again, because I want to keep things complicated and not be simplistic here. And he said it was essential for a republic. He just aptly free press was vital to keep citizens informed and acting as a check on the on public authority. Absolutely. And he also saw the press as a watchdog. As in a sense, guarding against the abuse of power by public officials. However, and this is important, at the same time, he did not hesitate to criticize the press. And this is why it's let's not over. He says, it can that it can entire times misinform the public. He said sometimes was filled with things that were newspaper that just weren't true. Partisan biases. Well, he recognized the partisan nature of the press. And basically, he hoped that the press would self-regulate by adhering to true facts and sound principles, but acknowledged the difficulty of achieving this. But that's what he want. He was championing the freedom of the press, but saying
Right. Yeah.
self-regulate.
Right. Yeah. And
Don't.
that's difficult in today's environment when you have honestly such vast amount of different types of media and outlets. You have more than just the cable stations. You've got the internet, which has everything possible. And you even just have citizen reporters. One thing I've been kind of enjoying on TikTok recently is people who live in Portland who are like, wow, look how dangerous our city is. I'm at the farmers market, which is kind of a silly thing, but it's also, a political criticism of what's going on and the truth according, to them. So it's hard to
What's going
regulate.
on? And Denise, what's going on? We should make clear it's not just a threat to journalism. You just said it's citizens too. what's being attacked is not just freedom of the press, but freedom of speech. And that's pretty, and that's pretty important to make that point, because this isn't just there is it's not just the working professional journalists are being targeted. It is a war on speech, free speech, the expression of an opinion by any of us, whether it's coming in a formal newspaper article or, I mean, this current administration banned the Associated Press from certain press events because it didn't refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, as they were instructed to do. We had our beloved late night television personality almost lose his show because he had said something that they didn't like. It's he's calling the Trump right now is suing the New York Times for like $15 billion.
He sued him of them a few times, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's done tries it's always gets thrown out, but I
Well,
wouldn't,
yeah. Which is good, the courts are doing what they're supposed to do.
But above all, what's going on is this is a per, per, there is a persecution of people based on point of view, not what they've done, but just on the on point of view. And of course, this is pretty diametrically exactly what the Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment prohibits. Here we go.
Here we go. Exactly. I'm encouraged to hear that that the LJ program is doing well, because I fear with the attacks on journalists, his censorship and criticism on journalists and lawyers as well, that those fields are, I don't know, maybe when you're 22, you don't think about those things, but that they're hopefully going to still flourish with good quality people, because it's scary. It's a scary environment,
They are my LJ majors are the future.
I love it. I love it. I really do. I've always been so grateful for my time at UC Irvine, despite the ridiculous commute for me. It was worth every second, every curse word I uttered while sitting in traffic.
That's good. That's
It was wonderful. All right, well, I got a couple more questions for you, and then I know you are limited on your time. So we're talking about the media. Let's talk kind of political criticism. Do you think the media should be allowed to criticize the government without limits?
I don't know what those limits would be, and who's going to define the limits, who's going to impose and enforce the limits. So it's kind of I mean that it's actually scary. Though I should tell you, in earlier times, it wasn't you didn't have ex it was still two forces, the fourth estate again, but there would be at least some communication. And I don't know, if your listeners know this, but for instance, when the John Kennedy, President Kennedy administration, this is back in the early 1960s, was preparing to invade Cuba, the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the New York Times learned of it ahead of time. And they called in the president called in the editor in chief and publisher of the New York Times and talked about the relative the safety of their armed forces, if and the New York Times wasn't forced at that time. They agreed to hold back on a story, which in retrospect they questioned that because the Bay of Pigs was a disaster, and the invasion was a disaster. And you started thinking afterwards, well, we probably should have, what would happen if we had told that? More recently, the New York Times was editor was called in, not recently, but not that long ago, by President Bush, George Bush, second Bush, Bush two, and because they had learned about the fact that the administration was essentially eavesdropping on telephone calls of people inside the United States, just anybody and everybody. Obviously, they were looking for certain things, but they were plugging into, and again, the New York Times had it, and again, the editor in chief was called in to meet with Bush, but Bush, it wasn't ordered, or wasn't it, they couldn't. They were, no, Bush argued for them, pled for them to not, and New York Times decided to publish anyway in the case. Okay, that's how. So there've been, my point being that there was negotiations and talking about certain things when it might affect national security or lives of our armed forces. Just suggest that we're not be allowed to should media be allowed to criticize the government without limits? Short answer, yes.
Absolutely. And then you had the Atlantic editor accidentally included on the Signal chat with Pete Hegseth and all of that. And he decided not to, he waited, didn't he, to which was really interesting, honestly. And probably there were some discussions at the Atlantic about what to do there.
Well, I think that the point here is simply that it's we're not it's not the it's we're not irresponsible, and that it's I can just tell you that I know. I mean, it's momentous consequences sometimes, and that we're aware of that.
Absolutely.
That's why you middle of the night stare up at the ceiling. It's the consequences about these things, and nothing is done without due consideration, I think.
Absolutely. All right, so last question for you. We talked a little bit about this earlier about confirmation bias and how people really go to the media outlet that plays into that confirmation bias. Do you think it's possible to share balanced news and be successful in today's rather high-charged, divisive climate?
Oh, Jerusa, I so wish I could say yes,
I
but
know, me
I
too.
so wish I did. I so wish. But the truth is I don't see how. I don't see how. And it has to do with, it partially just has to do with how polarized everybody is in the world, the deep polarization. But it also has to do with, again, back to business models and marketing and stuff. You've got these different platforms and publications and stations with a targeted audience rather than a general one. That's what, when you asked me much earlier in our conversation about what had changed, and that in the past, that was what it was, is that you were speaking to a broad general audience, or writing to. And so when I say polarization, it's not just a political polarization, it's an economic kind of breakdown. Fox News can't they'll lose their targeted audience if they don't do X, Y, and Z, and MSNBC has, and this, that, and the other thing. So, alas,
I know.
I wish,
I know.
and
I know. I started this podcast thinking I could be balanced, and I try to be, but try to represent all sides. But I have a perspective, and have things I want to say that, especially in today's climate, so it's hard to completely be, you can't be neutral, I guess,
Well, Jason, your particular endeavor here with this podcast, you would not succeed if you were in a balance. You see, I mean, it's important. You need to have a perspective, a point of view, a voice. Otherwise, why are we tuning into your
What is this?
podcast? That's exactly the dynamic of it. What would be nice is if we all could at least go to our foundational information source, and then from there share our varying perspectives and responses. But I don't think it's your role in what you're doing to provide that, and it wouldn't work.
Yeah, that's true. That's so true. Oh, well, I
So,
cannot thank you enough for this interview. And again, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
please do send me that link and stay in touch.